Kia ora and welcome to Cinema in Context, where we discuss all things film and the connections between. My name is Jeremy Downing.
I'm Sarah Watt.
And I'm William Chan.
And each month at Cinema in Context, we discuss two films, one current and one retrospective with some connection. It could be the same director, the same actor, or a similar theme. This month, we are discussing Dune Part 2, which came out earlier this year, and The Empire Strikes Back, otherwise known as Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back, depending on which decade you're watching this in, which came out in 1980. The connection being they are both space opera sequels. And that's the only connection. I think it's fair to say that there are some of the biggest spoilers in cinema history in these films, or particularly one of these movies.
Yeah.
So we will be spoilering both films. So if you haven't seen either Dune Part 2 or The Empire Strikes Back, I suggest pausing this episode and coming back to it at a future date. All right, William, give us a bit of an overview of 1980s The Empire Strikes Back.
The sequel to Star Wars, the 1977 bonanza blockbuster hit featuring farm boys, princesses, space battles, a very, very straightforward good versus evil, daring do Saturday morning matinee, you know, space adventure. Everything is very, very simple. Jump forward 3 years and we move into the dark, brooding teenage period of the Star Wars saga where instead of George Lucas directing, he passed it on to his former teacher, Irvin Kershner. And it really becomes the epitome of the sequel, which takes everything that the first movie sets up and builds upon it in very, very different ways, but in a way that enriches the characters, the settings, and the overall worldview of the franchise. Our heroes, Luke Skywalker, Leia Organa, and Han Solo, are set on their different paths throughout the galaxy while pursued by the villainous Darth Vader as the Empire, as is suggested in the title, strikes back after their brief defeat in Star Wars.
Nice.
Wonderfully done.
Wonderful. Well, Dune 2 follows Dune Part.
Can I just say it should be called To Dune 2 Sandy? Okay, anyway, yeah. Rather than Dune 2, but anyway, yeah.
Or Dune Part 2.
Yeah, yeah.
By the way, I rewatched Dune Part 1 in preparation for this episode.
Yeah.
And I was quite stoked that is called Dune Part 1. Like, yeah. It's in the in the film. So I guess it's fair to say they always knew that Dune Part 1 was needing a part two.
Mm-hmm.
And part two is the second half of the novel by Frank Herbert, which came out... When did the novel come out? In the 70s? 60s. Okay, cool. So this influential space text. And it's been unsuccessfully adapted multiple times. And with one in 1984 coming to fruition that has middling reviews, and then a TV series in 2000, which has middling reviews. But I think it's fair to say that director Denis Villeneuve has successfully adapted the novel by Frank Herbert. So Dune Part 2 starts with our lead, Paul Atreides, and his, I guess, new confidant and eventual lover, who is...
Zendaya.
Yeah, but what's
Chani?
Chani. Living with the Fremen, the indigenous native people of the Dune planet, Arrakis, and learning their ways. It follows on the political tensions of the House of... It's Atreides, isn't it? Mm-hmm. There's so many names in this.
Yeah.
So it follows on the decimation of House Atreides, with really the only two significant survivors being Paul and his mother Jessica, living with the Fremen, unbeknownst to the big bads of the series, the Harkonnens, who are looking to reclaim their power over Arrakis and, more importantly, spice this psycho... What do you want to call it? What is it called when you take...
Psychotropic?
Psychotropic.
Yeah. But it's a fuel as well, isn't it? That's
exactly.
The whole point. Is
psychotropic substance as well as a fuel to help with space travel. Yeah, I guess it's... I mean, I'm struggling to explain it because there's so much exposition even to get to the plot.
Mm.
But fair to say, this really looks at balancing on the knife edge between prophecy and politics and how a character like Paul can navigate between two such tensions. But yeah, that's nice. Dune Part 2.
Mm. Can I just say the reason I opted not to announce the plot of either film? Star Wars I grew up with and I know a little better who the characters are. I'm terrible though with Dune. I'm like, well, then of course Florence Pugh comes along and she does this. And then Stellan Skarsgård does this. And Timothy Chalamet, blah, blah, blah. So, you know. Yeah. And then they go to this place that's all a bit like blah. So I'm not very good with my jargon. So bear with. Yeah. Bear with.
So we've got Paul Atreides, Jessica. Is she an Atreides? They're not married, are they?
No. She was a concubine. Yeah. She was Oscar Isaac's concubine. But obviously mm-hmm. he loved her and was devoted to her.
And he says in the first film, I wish I'd married you. Mm-hmm. Or I should have married you.
Yeah. Now here I call him Oscar Isaac. What was his name?
Duke Leto Atreides.
Oh, okay. Because
as in Jared Leto.
Yes. Oh, I see. Because, can I just say, I've always thought it was a bit hilarious that we're like in the future and it's amazing and they're called Paul and Jessica. I just think, who wrote this?
You welcome to the 1960s.
Yeah. Or the 80s. Yeah. You know, then all they need is a Sarah or several Sarahs and then it's, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that's hilarious.
Well, I mean, you know, on that note, Sarah, what was your thoughts of Dune Part 2?
I loved Dune Part 2. When I saw Dune Part 1 in the cinema, I remember at the time going, this is amazing. And then I came out and went, meh. And even though I'm pretty sure I gave it 4 stars, I was like, don't really care. Don't really understand what was going on. Don't care about what was going on. Don't need to see it again. But like you, Jeremy, I rewatched Part 1 just before seeing Part 2. And not only was Part 1 amazing, but we watched it a day or two, no more than that, in advance of Part 2. And Part 2 was extraordinary, and I would see it again. And we did see it at the IMAX, you know, that everybody would say, the bigger, the better, blah, 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 blah. And but everything that Sarah's like best, you know, it doesn't have to be big and bombastic for me, but I need it to be goey and engaging and interesting, and the political and the this and the that and the acting and all of that stuff I just thought was tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, loved it. Loved nice. It.
William, what was your experience?
I liked it a lot. I think I like Part 1 maybe more.
Controversial.
I mean, it's interesting because they are, as you say, Jeremy, 2 halves of a whole. But how the films are laid out, especially the momentum of the films, reminds me a lot of Fellowship of the Ring and Two Towers, right? Whereas Fellowship is, even though it has a definitive ending, it's very much about a plot-driven quest.
Mm.
And then stuff happens and everything flows along chronologically. And there's a real sense of, and then this happened, and so this happened, and so this happened. Whereas Dune 2, or Part 2, is much more fragmented, and there's a lot more happening.
Yes.
Like, so much more happening. And overall, even with, like, the big action denouements, I just felt like it wasn't as satisfying to me as Part 1, where there were some scenes in Part 1 just which blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one scene in particular in Dune 2 which did that. But otherwise, it didn't feel as satisfying as a whole, I guess.
Mm. What was the blow-away one?
Tell us. Gosh. I mean, obviously, the Paul, central
Paul riding the
Paul sand. Riding the sandworm.
Yeah.
There's
really?
Certain scenes in that where it's a POV from Paul's, you know, the sand is everywhere.
Right.
He sees this massive dune in front of him. And where's the audience? Are just behind him the whole time, going through mountains, going, you know, the scale is immense.
Mm.
And then, of course, they do the Spielberg thing of having the Fremen and the other main characters in the distance looking at this tiny figure and just their faces. It's extraordinarily done.
That one shot where the sand is all in the camera and then it just opens out and it's almost like he's flying over the sand. It's so clever. And I watched a YouTube video of Denis Villeneuve breaking down that scene, and he said that was the one moment where he wanted to deviate the least from the book because he had such a strong memory of reading that as a teenager. And I think the dialogue is almost verbatim from the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really impressive. I loved the film. I watched the first one. We'd have been in lockdown a number of weeks, and it was the first thing I watched when I got out of lockdown, and then immediately went back a week later to rewatch the first one. And I thought the second one was, it was the payoff of all the things the first one set up. I absolutely loved it. And there are things about the first film that did kind of frustrate me a little bit. The fact that I did feel like it ended without an ending.
Mm.
But then in re-watching it again, having watched the second one, understanding the mirroring one-on-one combats at the end of each film, And how the first one has a significance of effectively Paul becoming Fremen, or what's the word they use where he becomes like the Fremen? I can't remember. Some word they use. And then the end of it, of course, ascending to becoming a version of the Emperor, or you know, this side of the war. So it made me, the second one made me appreciate the first one more. And I went and saw the second one, and then I, like I said, I rewatched the first one and then rewatched the second one. So I've seen them all a few times. Mm-hmm. And there are things in the first one as well that are so cleverly setting up the second one. You know, the field mouse, the sand mouse, and how that appears in the first film. The visions. Now, one of the really clever moments is there's a vision in the first one where Paul is, well, there's someone fighting, there's a Fremen fighter, and then he turns and he pulls off his mask and it's Paul's face. Mm. Well, in the film, the second film...
That happens in The Empire Strikes Back!
It does, but in the second Dune film, that shot happens, but it's Zendaya's character. Mm. And so the kind of payoff of that dream is not that he literally is there, but that it is through his leadership that she is enacting that. You know, just the kind of very clever ways that they're building in those elements of foreshadowing and prophecy. I just thought the second one was absolutely spectacular. I think the twist, I didn't know the story, and so the twist that of his my words are stumbling all over.
It's not his parentage, but you're right. It's his heritage, his ancestry.
Is grandparentage a word?
What, is he a grandparent or is he an uncle?
A grandparent.
Because he calls him grandfather at the end.
Oh, yeah.
So he's Jessica's father.
That's right. So Stellan Skarsgård.
Yeah. And apparently, what's her name? Rebecca Ferguson said that one of her favourite scenes from the first film was cut. But she's like, this is what happens. She apparently had a dream where she was lying on the floor, and then Stellan Skarsgård's character's great weight sort of squashes her and suffocates her. And she says, now knowing what happens in the second film,
she understands why that scene was there.
Yeah, but then I think it was too telling of this connection. I think maybe Denis Villeneuve had to remove it to save that secret.
Right.
Yeah. Cool.
Hey, it's worth saying, and I know that obviously people who are listening to this will know this, but I thought it was hilarious how Dune Part 2, do you remember that when we said to you, William, well, there's going to be a Part 3, and you were like, what?
Yeah, I just thought they would finish the book.
No.
And full stop.
They unfinish it more than they did in Dune 1, in a way. Like, you're right, there was a clear sense at the end of Dune 1 there's more to happen, but there's a massive... I mean, Dune 2 is literally... Well, actually, I can't even give you a...
I mean, I didn't appreciate the gravity of how the film ended, because the first time I watched it, I was like, oh, that's an interesting choice ending on... I can't remember her name, still Shandy? No, what is it?
Chani. Yeah.
Chani. Ending on her face, and knowing that the film was going to that point, I watched, obviously, both parts with that in mind.
Mm.
And, you know, realising, oh, she is the only one that both loves Paul for who he is, and also hates him for what he's become.
Yeah.
Everybody else is sort of drinking the Paul Kool-Aid.
Yeah, nice.
Or used him as a puppet. Like, even Jessica, you know, I'm not confident that she's got his best interest at heart.
No.
But that's what a wonderful ending to the film on her face.
And it's so, so different from the books, right?
Right.
It's a complete, not invention's the wrong word, but an adaptation that, you know, because Charlie in the books is Team Paul all the way.
Right. So how does the end of the book, given that the end of Part 2 film is the end of the book, does it end on a big cliffhanger where he goes, sorry, Charlie, I'm going to marry Florence Pugh for political reasons?
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, and it ends and we're meant to just go, bums.
Because later on in the books, like, she kind of becomes the Lady Jessica of his life.
Who, where, Florence does?
No, Charlie does.
Right.
Like,
his concubine.
Yeah, so they have children together.
Spoilers!
I'm sorry. So the books are published a while ago.
No, I know. Wow, though. So part three.
Yeah, so Florence Pugh is, she's only there as a symbol.
Yes.
And she ends up quite loving Paul, but again, is held at arm's length.
You can tell in the film, what I think is quite nicely done, is that Florence Pugh's character, as much as she feels, I'm projecting, but it feels as though she's going, oh, I know this is a political wedding, but actually I quite like him. Mm, and this could be really lovely.
It's already setting it up.
And she's already looked over it. Concubine to be, she knows that his heart's actually with this other chick. So you know, so to me as a girl, maybe, or maybe that's sexist, but to me as somebody who enjoys the sort of the tricky relationship drama of it all, that's already building up to be something where she's going to feel insecure because she knows that Timothy Chalamet really loves Zendaya, But Zendaya's gone and blah, blah, blah.
It's set up so well in that scene because everyone bows.
I was going to say, the staging is amazing.
The two of them are standing there, they see each other and instantly realize, oh, this is what's happening.
Yeah. The staging is incredible. Mm-hmm. And it's so, it makes so much sense from a political reason or like a character motivation reason and for the audience to understand exactly what's going on and give. And like, I remember, there's also that moment where Elvis, what's his name? Austin Butler's character. He says, oh, is this your pet? And I'm like, that's there. So that Florence Pugh's character gets that piece of information. That's the only reason that's
right,
there.
That's right. Yeah.
So that otherwise, how do you bring that exposition in?
I mean, that's right.
This, these films do such a good job of bringing in exposition in non clunky ways.
Compared to the David Lynch dude,
which everybody has an internal monologue.
I know that we're going to make a comparison with the old Empire Strikes Back, but also it's a very big comparison with Prince Charles, who like had to marry Princess Diana or Lady Diana Spencer, but his concubine was actually Camilla Parker Bowles. And they knew the whole time, and then eventually he wound up with her.
So who, what's the sandworm in this, this analogy?
Well,
it was the mom batter.
The corgis. So my understanding, I've heard Denis Villeneuve say he got that ending from the book. That moment with Chani at the end.
I don't. Wait. That she goes away.
No, that it ends on her. The book ends on.
But she's totally devoted to him and his ideals through the entire thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's
so
kind
the
of
context
like,
is very very
so
different.
So it's like instead of her looking pissed off about it.
Yeah.
She understands he's got to marry Florence Pugh for political reasons.
Yes.
But how exciting is that ending, though, the film ending? Like, they're so charged.
Yeah.
And he said he wants to make a third one. But my understanding, and have you read the third book?
The second book.
Oh, second book, sorry. So my understanding is that it takes place 10 years after the Holy Wars happened. Jessica's not around. So I've read an article about how for them to make an exact adaptation of that book, it would feel quite different to what we've seen. So I'm wondering if he's going to show more of
there's also the big change of Alia, so poor sister, who just pops up as Anya Taylor-Joy she's in this
it's
movie.
It's like 7 seconds and she's still got to go to the premiere in a nice dress. Gosh. So she better be in the third film.
Is she supposed to be the thing, that the kind of that being?
She's the one that talks to Jessica from In Utero.
But the Bene Gesserit keep talking about the something something.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's supposed to be her.
She ends up being, again, the messiah figure.
Right,
But she is already born in the books, because the training sequence in the books takes place over, I think it's like 5 years.
Right.
And in this, Lady Jessica is still pregnant with her, so it's within the span of 9 months, so everything's condensed.
Yeah.
I guess to streamline the story, and it does work, apart from the fact that a lot of what happens is, like, there's a toddler walking around, and she's super psychic, and they adapted so that she is talking to her mother while in the womb.
Yeah.
Which is very, very cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah.
And all those amazing shots of the fetus and the baby with a hand on the... Yeah. Oh, it's just lots of key choices.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So can we start drawing a little diagram, you know, a comparison diagram with... I always want to call it Empire of the Sun. It's not that. What's it called? The Empire Strikes Back. One thing that's... So it's really funny, William, and readers, listeners, watchers may or may not be amused to know. So what we'll often do is we choose a film and then we think, what's it going to pair with? And for a moment there, we were thinking, well, maybe The Two Towers, because as you say, it's a quest film. The first one's a quest film. But then Jeremy and I saw Dune 2 and also saw there's a wonderful thing on the internet that basically says, not entirely kindly, how Dune 2 stole all its ideas from... Which way round?
Star Wars.
Star Wars.
Basically, and all the things that are the same. You've got the little creature with the
ears. Have you seen Herbert's dig at
Lucas?
Do you know this?
No.
So I was going to share it with you, with you two in the chat, but I thought I'd save it for now. So my friend, a friend of mine, an ex-flat mate, I messaged him because we got some mail at our house, and I said I'd watch it, and he said to me, "Oh, there's a dig in one of the books because Frank Herbert famously." Felt like Star Wars was a rip-off. And so in his novel, The Heretics of Dune, which came out in 1984, do you know how this falls into the series?
No.
So one of the Dune sequels. Here is a little excerpt. Are you ready? From the most ancient times, the knowledgeable had preferred to surround themselves with fine woods rather than the mass-produced artificial materials known then as Polestine, Polaz, and Pormabat, latterly Tyne, Laz, and Bat. As far back as the old empire, there had been a pejorative label for the small and for the small rich and families minor arising from the knowledge of rare wood's value. He's a 3PO, they said, meaning such a person surrounded himself with cheap copies made from déclassé substances.
Oh, boom.
So there you go. Polystyne, Polaz.
So it's tricky, isn't it? Because 3PO.
A huge passage that's a setup for a pun.
So dumb.
So there's burn.
The books. So there's the Frank Herbert books, and then there's the 77 Star Wars, and then the 1984 Empire Strikes Back, and then there's Dune 1, and then there's Dune 2. So, I mean, you know, it's not exactly a chicken and egg situation. And you could argue there are only so many ways you can do a sci-fi, but there do seem to be lots of similarities. I'm not saying anybody nicked anything from anybody.
Although, I mean, there's a friggin' sandworm in Empire Strikes Back, which is hilarious.
Asteroid worm. But I mean, I think that he's definitely pulled from Dune, and I don't think that's like... I think for Frank Herbert to claim, you know, plagiarism, it's like, oh, dude, you know, you've been a huge piece. I mean, Lucas famously took from... Kurosawa as well. Cereals. It's a pastiche. It's a Tarantino pastiche of
Joseph Campbell, all sort of King Arthur, all that Rings. Stuff. Yeah.
So I don't mean to be like basic, but one of the things that struck me that I hadn't read online, so I'm not trying to be all like, oh my god, I came up with this, because I'm sure that everybody knows this already. But the love triangle, if you will, is interesting to me. If you think that
An Empire Strikes Back.
No, both of them. Oh. Here's the funny thing, right? If you think that Timothy Chalamet, being the bloke with two girls, what a sexist way to put it. Two women, both women care for him. But if you think...
In the books, it's hilarious as well, because they're described as just like really, really hot.
But here's the thing.
I think Princess Irulan is... I need to find an excerpt. She's like, you know, the premier beauty of the galaxy and like... Man, she's really good looking, you guys.
But bear with me. Who's that? Florence Pugh.
Florence Pugh.
Yeah, and she is. Now, let me get this straight. Florence Pugh's dad is, or was, the Emperor, right? Mm-hmm. But she's not biologically related to Timothy Chalamet, is she?
No,
not in this case. Okay, so where I'm about to go with this is that Leia is biologically related to Luke Skywalker. Although we don't know that, do we, in the second film?
And I'm pretty sure it wasn't written as such in the second film.
Yeah, it's so clear.
No, but both of them... really love the other one, Han Solo and Zendaya. I'm such a mix with my character names. But both of them, do you remember that? Well, you do remember because you've just rewatched it. That bit in The Empire Strikes Back where she kisses Luke just to make him jealous. Yeah. So there's that same kind of, you know, well, I'm going to marry Florence Pugh. But okay, it's not a great argument.
Let's go, there's a love triangle.
Okay. They're, and then I'll just stop there.
Yeah. But, and I mean, in this case, I mean, you mentioned there's the asteroid worm, but is the sandworm really Yoda in this?
No. Yoda is the little creature with the ears.
No, I know.
Oh, are they the Ewoks?
Yoda's the green one.
No, yeah, I know who Yoda is. No, but hang on. Okay, but you know the little...
The little mouse, the kangaroo mouse.
Yeah, the kangaroo mouse. Is that like Ewoks? Which we haven't had yet because we haven't watched the third one.
Yoda, he's Javier Bardem, right?
Oh, true.
He's the guy who, you know, partakes and shares in the wisdom of the universe.
Yeah, except that Javier Bardem, isn't he? Okay, so can we just say... Monty Python's Life of Brian.
We almost paired it with this.
Yeah. I know.
I watched it and the first thing that popped to mind was, this is Life of Brian.
This is so funny. You're the Messiah. No, I'm not. And all that stuff. But, oh my God, only he who says that he isn't is. Yeah. All right, then I'm not. There we are. No, I am. Anyway, Javier Bardem's character is so unexpected to me because the film is very serious and there's serious stuff going on. And from Dune 1, where they dare to kill Oscar Isaac, and that whole kind of like scene of attacking the palace and everything was extraordinary. So then all of a sudden we get this dude who, with the sparkly blue eyes and the wry kind of accent and the wry way of speaking, who is so funny and so persistent that this chap is going to be somebody. What a fabulous character. So I guess the difference there, though, is that Javier Bardem's character is like, yeah, yeah, nah, you're totally this guy. Whereas Yoda spends a lot of time going, this can't be right. This guy's a jerk.
What an amazing character. And rewatching it, I actually didn't rewatch. I mean, I've seen this film so many times and rewatched so many times. But the way that I rewatched it for this episode was I watched one of my favorite YouTube reactors.
Which? Empire Strikes Back.
Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is a couple. The channel's called Just Trust Ash, and him and his girlfriend Hannah, they react to lots of things, and they watched it, and they'd never seen it, and they didn't know the Darth Vader reveal.
So they
were so blown away. Mm. They had to pause. I was like, oh my gosh, how have you got away with watching movies and don't know this? But they didn't know Yoda as well, so they were just enjoying him being this annoying little creature.
I love it.
And then when it revealed that he was Yoda, they're like, wait, what? It was such an entertaining way to watch it.
That's lovely.
Yoda's so brilliantly put together. And
the characterization is incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He, like, you believe he's a Jedi Master, and he's a flippin' puppet.
Yeah, he's a frog man.
Yeah.
And like, when he first appears and he's just this goofy little dude, he's messing with Luke's stuff,
and you think that's a really interesting point. I found that watching it this time, because when you're little and you watch it, it's all you've never seen anything like it before, and so you're like, oh my god, and your suspension of disbelief is really easy. And now, you're so right, when I first saw Yoda this time round, I went, oh my god, he looks like a Muppet. And then when he's throwing the things around and all that, you're like, oh, this is really kind of dumb. And then you get used to him being an actual creature, an actual, I want to say person, but you know what I mean?
Completely believable.
Isn't that interesting?
The acting as well. I mean, it's Frank Oz plus a lot of Muppeteers.
Yes.
Literally a Muppet. But there's this one scene that really blew me away. It's when he... yeah, he's talking to Luke and Obi-Wan's ghost, and his head turns from one to the other, and it's the most subtle acting ever, and it's done by a team of puppeteers hiding underneath the bog. Like, how do they do that?
Well, they built the whole set about, you know, they had a whole other thing underneath, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
They sort of had, like, I don't know, 3/4 height of space underneath
so
the set.
So good.
This film is, you know, one of my favourite films of all time, and, you know, George Lucas created... a whole world with, you know, and reshaped cinema with Star Wars 1977. But I think handing the directing reins over, I didn't know there was this, I can't remember the
director's name. His former
teacher. Irving Kirshner.
Irving Kirshner, I didn't realise it was his former teacher. But he does a masterful job with this film. And it always astounds me watching this movie, how the stakes are so high, but it's so much fun. And this is the one thing I find with Return of the Jedi. I think I mentioned this to you. I find that Return of the Jedi comes to a screeching halt after the Tatooine sequence where Luke goes and visits Yoda to watch him die, and then there's the next part of the film. Mm. Whereas Empire is so expertly woven together.
Yeah.
And the escalating killing off of all of the different Empire
so
kernels,
funny,
or whatever they are. and really, this is the establishment of Darth Vader as a villain, because in the first movie, he's sort of a bit of a sidekick to Peter Cushing.
Yeah.
And in this one, he is...
Yeah, you're right. He's as heavy, right?
Yeah.
Is Peter Cushing the Emperor?
No.
Oh.
He's the leader of the Death Star.
Grand Moff Tarkin, who's like, yes, you may fire when ready.
Does he die in the first one or something?
Yeah, he dies in the Death Star.
Because in the second one, that the big scary dude who's like a hologram, he's the Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
But
he doesn't really come into it until the third one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I always grew up thinking... So here's the thing, and I know I've told you fellas this, and I wanted to get clarity on this before we did the podcast, and I didn't. The first time I ever went to the cinema, because I'm a little bit older than you, was to see a Star Wars film. And it was either 1977, which will have been probably 78 here by the time the film came out, which means I would have been 4, which is likely, given the context of the people that I went with, or it was the 1981. All I remember is a man being turned to gold, which of course happens sort of in a toddler's brain. That happens in Empire Strikes Back. And all I remember is that Darth Vader was absolutely the most terrifying creature I had ever seen. So whichever film it was, definitely he was enough of a character with that awful breathing that I was absolutely petrified.
Well, in the first one, he does strangle, you know, death strangle somebody, which
That's
is quite
right.
scary.
That's right.
The thing about this Empire Strikes Back that always what surprised me when I first realized it, and then it always impresses me, is it's the first time we hear the famous Empire theme.
Dun, 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 yeah. Bum, ba-dum. Do they not do that in the Star Wars?
No, that's an introduction to this film.
Oh.
Yeah, and it feels appropriate because, you know, it's the Empire theme, The Empire Strikes Back. And
yeah,
it's part and parcel with why Darth Vader is so domineering.
I wonder then, because you know how traditionally people tend to pick on a second film like The Godfather Part 2 or whatever, Aliens maybe, that's like the best one.
Mm-hmm.
This film, am I right in saying most people tend to think, fans tend to think Empire Strikes Back is better than Star Wars?
I think so, yeah.
And I wonder therefore if A, it's the age that people watched it, which will matter, or whether it's because it has these seminal things, it has an accomplished director in the chair, and these are the things that we take from it more than we did the first film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I think so. I mean, the first one's amazing.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing. But I mean, this one does that thing where it's like, takes the first one and then
doubles down.
Yeah.
I will say, I for a moment I thought, oh gosh, they're going to do that thing where they stick Luke off on this thread and they stick Leia and Han off on this thread and neither the three shall meet.
Classic sequel fear, right? I mean,
uh-huh. Yes.
Pirates of the Caribbean and, I mean, again, Lord of the Rings.
But it doesn't always work.
Yeah, right.
It has to be super engaging. Mm. And actually, in both these instances, it is super engaging. It totally does work.
I think what's fascinating about this watch through is I started realizing that the timeline actually doesn't make any sense. Because Han and Leia and Chewie and 3PO are on this madcap chase through the asteroids, whereas Luke spends months, question mark, training
really?
With Yoda in a swamp.
Mm.
Well, he's built muscle tone. He's like, he's learned the Force. And he's like, but Master Yoda, I've learned so much.
Oh, I see.
And then they
all,
they congregate in Cloud City at the same time.
Yeah.
Maybe they just spend a lot of time in the asteroids. I don't know. But again, watch the movie. You never question that because of the propulsiveness of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
What stood out to me when I was a kid watching this is that he becomes a Jedi Knight in the third film, and he's only really had the training in this one with Yoda, which is a small little short piece.
Conversation in the
third
one.
Yeah, or an asteroid chase.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always, it definitely doesn't hold up. If
you know what they don't have in this film? That every film subsequent would have is a bloomin' training montage.
Oh, there's a little bit of a training montage.
Yeah, I think so.
He just flips and he swings on
vines. I suppose there's a bit, but it's not like a dun, 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 chugga, 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 you know, and then we get to see the whole chugga, chugga.
Yeah.
Anyway. I mean, I'm just thinking of the montage where they kill all the Jedi in Revenge of the Sith. It's not a training montage as such.
One thing I was struck by is Carrie Fisher's really good. This may sound like a ridiculous thing to say. I then read up, and she was 19, and it was her second film, which I did know after, I think, Hair with Warren Beatty.
The first one. Yeah.
That was
Star
her first
Wars,
film.
Yeah.
Oh, no. What I'm saying, sorry, is Star Wars was her second film in her career, and she was 19, and Harrison Ford was 33, and yes, they did have an affair, and she was madly in love with him, as we found out, in 2016, shortly before her untimely demise at the age of 60.
Mm.
Anyhow, she's really terrific in this and really luminous and great. And one thing, the only thing that I noted down about this rewatch of Empire Strikes Back, though, is the workplace bullying and the sexual harassment. He is awful to her. This whole kind of, come on, you know you want it, you know I like you, you blah, 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 blah.
The very alpha male pointing.
Oh, my God.
Han Solo loves the point,
and
man.
The fact that he'll go behind her and grab her hands to do that. I mean, the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's just screamingly inappropriate.
Yeah.
And also, because she doesn't go, she goes, hey, leave me alone. Yeah. Get off. Stop touching my hands and all this stuff. But also, just the workplace bullying. He's so mean.
Oh, I thought you meant Darth Vader's workplace bullying.
No, well, there's that.
the way they treat C-3PO is terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's this annoyance that, like, brings up very valid information about the threat of
somebody
things.
Turn him off.
Yeah.
You know.
And then the punchline being the third time it happens, Leia's just like, oh, shut up.
Yeah. So all of that is terrible. The tone and everything is awful. But no, he's kind of a bully to her as well.
Yeah.
He's kind of snarky and, well, what would you know? And she's like, well, I do, and da da da. But also, blimmin' amazing characterization, status, and everything between the two of them. She isn't a wussy And we'll see
the payoff to all of that, where Han gets slightly more and more and more beaten up and beaten down. And then just the final declaration of love at the end. Apparently it was all ad-libbed, which is insane.
Which bit? Where she goes, I love you, and he goes, I know.
Because they've done the take so many times. Yeah. He just did it as a take. He's like, I know.
But do you know what? When I've seen that little clip, we had that clip in our wedding montage, and it always gets a laugh when it's on its own. Because you think, oh, it's Han Solo being arrogant. But actually, when I watched it in the context of a film where he's going, come on, just be honest, tell me how you feel. And she's like, no, I don't. And you're like, yes, you do. When she says it and he goes, I know, it didn't come off as funny or snarky to me.
No, I agree.
It came off as... I know, because we've been saying this the whole time, and
it only works. This relationship only works in light of his sexual harassment and bullying of others. It only works because she truly does love him.
Yeah.
And because of the way that she's had to live her life and her status, she's had to be hard on the edges, you know? And I think that's the only way that this works. Otherwise, it's just creepy.
Mm.
So I agree, and that's why it's such a great moment. And... Yeah. I think Carrie Fisher is just... I mean, they're all brilliant. The three leads are brilliant.
How did they cast this film? Cast Star Wars. It's just the biggest stroke of luck. Because, you know, Harrison Ford,
wasn't he a carpenter on set?
Well, he was. He did, like, American Graffiti and stuff.
Oh, right.
He's in the conversation.
Yeah. And then, like, Carrie Fisher's, you know, Hollywood kid, like, knows the system, brought up in the system.
But trained in London, right? She went over to the UK.
She trained at the Central School of Speech and Drama.
She jokingly talks about the first film. She's got a British accent that comes and goes.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Just like Natalie Portman's accent from Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
Yeah, Senator.
Yeah.
And then Mark Hamill, I guess, is the ingenue of the three. But he turns out, you know, to be this amazing actor, especially after Star Wars, and he becomes one of the preeminent voice actors of our time.
Mm.
And to get the three of them together in these three films, it's just extraordinary. Mm. I mean, Return of the Jedi is a little off because Harrison Ford just does not care about the movie. And you can see him kind of sleepwalk through the whole thing. But at least the first two, like, man, solid gold.
He is solid in the second one. Yeah. It's funny, I was thinking about him watching the film. I was thinking, I don't actually think that I regard him particularly as a particularly fine actor. Mm-hmm. I know he's done everything, but I immediately think of Air Force One and Patriot Games, which I love. But he's the same sort of surly Harrison Ford that he is actually when you see him at the Oscars or an awards do or giving a speech or whatever. So I don't actually... He's almost like a reluctant... I think he is something of a reluctant superstar, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I don't regard him that highly. Mark Hamill I thought was good, but do you know Mark Hamill in Empire Strikes Back is the archetype of all those 80s films, particularly Spielbergian 80s films, where you've got some kid who's like, oh, gee, this is annoying. What do we have to do? And they all like this, you know, and it's slightly big. Can't we just get on and meet this Yoda guy?
I don't even know what I'm doing here.
Right. And it's all a bit kind of much, right? Yeah. But it goes with the era, whereas you wouldn't get away with that now.
And also
Hayden Christensen.
Well, I don't like sand.
It goes with his teachings as well, right? Mm. Like his learning through Yoda... is that he can't be that guy, that he needs to learn patience and confidence and the whole thing, you know, I don't get it, Master, how could you lift the X-Wing? And then Yoda says, you know, that is why you fail.
Yeah.
Which is amazing stuff because that is the journey that Luke goes on and he realizes that being so headstrong and impatient leads to his defeat at the hands of Vader.
Yeah.
And he shouldn't have gone there.
Yeah.
As both Obi-Wan and Yoda told him not to.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
whole final sequence, that fight is amazing. And then to have, you know, in your cards, this huge reveal that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
It's the only twist, I think, that actually works in that series because I don't ever feel like the reveal of Leia and Luke
so
being
silly.
Siblings. I mean, there is that line, though, in the Empire Strikes Back where it's like, there is another.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then there is the hint that he can speak to Leia. So maybe they did know at that point. But it doesn't feel like it serves the story in the same way that the Darth Vader reveal does.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the Darth Vader reveal, has being his father, has huge implications for the plot of the third film.
Yeah.
And I always found the whole premise of these six films being the rise and fall, the tragedy of Anakin Skywalker, a really interesting idea.
Mm.
And where I think the prequel films trip up is that they make him the lead. When I do think the lead, and I've seen a video essay on this, where the lead should really have been Obi-Wan Kenobi. Mm. So you get Obi-Wan's story in the first three films and Luke's story in the next three films, but overarching that in the background is the story of Darth Vader. Because otherwise, it doesn't work in the prequels because it's just a tragedy. whereas if you'd had Obi-Wan's journey of dealing with revenge being the kind of the driver of that and then getting over it.
Yeah.
And Anakin being the dark mirror of that.
Right.
It's a far more interesting kind of piece to that puzzle.
Right.
Nice. Yeah. And also, I guess, just George Lucas, you know, as visionary a director as he is, he just can't direct actors.
Yeah, it's true.
So you may already know this, but with Irvin Kershner, is that how I'm saying it? Yeah, mm-hmm. So Irvin Kershner was brought in because he knew, Lucas knew, because he'd written the three films, right? But he knew that he needed somebody who could handle the relationship drama. Mm-hmm. And so that's why he got the sort of the more serious or the more experienced director in, which is such a humble, wonderful way of doing it.
It's a shame that he didn't do that for the prequels or within Indiana Jones, where he writes the stories and then he hands them over to screenwriters and then Spielberg would direct them. I just think that it would really serve his vision more, and because there's some really cool stuff in the prequels.
Yeah. Did he direct the prequels?
Yes.
But I suppose, by then you see he's an experienced director, so why would he give it
away?
He's
not, though. He's only done, the last one we did was Star Wars.
Okay, but I guess what I mean is he's older, I suppose, and so therefore maybe he... No, but you know what I mean? He's older and he's in the business now, rather than it's being like, oh, I had Star Wars and that was a bit of a fluke and I don't want to mess this up, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
He just seems to me as much more of an ideas guy than someone who could actually bring those ideas into fruition.
Yeah.
On that note, I think one of the unsung superstars of the Dune films is Denis Villeneuve's directing actors.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The acting is impeccable and it's so... It feels so nuanced and fresh and
effortless.
Real. Yes. I mean, when you've got Christopher Walken there, and I forget it's Christopher Walken.
That is a big feat.
I was like, hey, it's Christopher Walken.
Yeah, but it was Chris a little toned down.
He's been that way for years. He's there and he's got the hair. And I don't know. For me, it's like, oh, okay, that's a famous guy.
Yeah.
Well, I think Timothy Chalamet did an amazing job.
Yes.
I think Zendaya was brilliant because she's not really much in the first one.
She's only in the first one for 7 minutes total.
Yeah,
she's on all the posters.
But because you see her often, mm-hmm. 7 minutes will add up if you're doing like just several visions, right?
Yeah.
We all felt like she was fully in it, but she's not.
She does a lot in the second one.
Yes.
Do you think the third one will start with some, because the first one starts with a prologue voiceover by Zendaya. The next one starts with a sort of prologue voiceover by
Florence Pugh.
I wonder if the third one will be
Anya Taylor-Joy. Well, she's got to earn having turned up on the red carpet.
Yeah, and then they'll end with some kind of one-on-one knife fight at the end of that one as well.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. It feels like there's a formula that's been established.
Yeah. Just while we're talking about directors, and I hope we still have time, just to speak a little about Denis Villeneuve. I think he is really extraordinary and special, and it was very unexpected to me. The first film of his that I saw was Incendie back in the early 2000s. And it's so Denis Villeneuve, as we know, is Canadian, and he is obviously French Canadian. And he does this extraordinary film set in the Middle East and Canada called Incendie. And if you haven't seen it, Incendies. If you haven't seen it, you totally should, because it is an extraordinarily acted, very, very tricky relationship or family drama. And the twists and the plot and everything is extraordinary. So he did that. And then am I saying that he did? Did he do Prisoners?
This one I remember.
Right. So
Prisoners is what I remember. Yeah.
And Prisoners I remember, therefore, as being, oh, he's come to America and he's doing Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal and la-li-la-la. It wasn't as satisfying for me, but it was still a blimmin' good, you know, at least 4 out of 5 film.
Incendies?
Yeah.
Prisoners blew me away.
Right.
Like, what is this?
So then when they chucked him into Blade Runner, I was like, well, that's unusual. What are they thinking? You know, and of course he did it with aplomb. Yeah. And I guess that's obviously the reason that they said, well, this dude can deal with sandy, orange-toned planets, so we'll give him Dune. I just think, and I know there's a rival and a whole lot. I mean, I think he's a really special guy.
Yeah, I agree. And we haven't even talked about the Hans Zimmer score. We talked about the music of John Williams and... in Empire Strikes Back, which is, you know, one of the greatest soundtracks of all time.
Of all time.
And Hans Zimmer will reference John Williams as being, I've heard him say it, he's the greatest cinema composer we've ever had.
Yes.
And I think I could agree with that. But I think the soundtrack in Dune is so good.
It is.
Did you listen to that 30-minute?
Yes, you sent us a lovely podcast of him explaining how he broke down or how he came up with one of the themes, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting. I hate to say it. There's a part of me, though. You remember a year or so ago, there was this furore about the fact that Hans Zimmer now, of course, because he has come up through the ranks and he is now his own brand, he has a retinue of young composers working for him, often without credit. And sometimes probably without pay. But you know what I mean? Without credit. So I thought to myself, yeah, but how much of this did he really come up with? You know, that's unfortunate now that I'm like, yeah, but did he really come up with that bit? I will just say, I loved the soundtrack watching the film. It was absolutely intoxicating. It was immersive and amazing. But unfortunately, I spend a lot of time on Instagram. And every man and his dog is now doing an Instagram reel where they're going, wah! And they're doing some sort of jokey pastiche, whether it's a dog on a mop coming around the kitchen floor or something, and they're ruining it for me because it's now just become too popular.
There's just that one moment that I think the soundtrack doesn't work, which is when Zendaya shows up and then the Dune One Woman Whale starts playing, and it's almost like a pastiche within the film itself.
Oh, yeah.
I think both movies, though, have really lovely love themes.
That I was going to say about the Han Solo and Leia love theme.
Leia's theme is so good.
Yeah.
And it carries on throughout the movie as well.
Every moment, though, every moment they step into frame together, it goes...
And the same with... Chani and Paul. Their theme is very subtle. And every time they're on screen, it appears. It's really lovely.
I think my favourite bit in The Empire with that theme is the action sequence in Cloud City at the end. And it's using that theme as the backdrop. And R2 is using the fire extinguisher. C-3PO is like, wonderful. And it's just, it's such amazing feelings. My criticism of that theme is... Gosh, so what? Superman the movie was 78, right? Empire was 80, and then Indiana Jones was 81.
Yeah.
Compare Lois Lane's theme, Leia's theme, and Marin's theme. It's just the same piece of music.
Yeah.
It's variations on a theme.
Yeah.
And they all sound real good, but he's kind of plagiarizing himself.
Well, they do, though, and Zimmer does. You know, that's how we... Yeah, that's how you spot a Zimmer score, isn't it? But
Do you want to do final thoughts? Or should we end here?
No, let's do final thoughts.
Okay, jump in, William. Final thoughts.
That's all right. Dune, I thought it was visually, you know, spectacular in all the ways. Once again, just as I started the podcast, I did enjoy Dune Part 1 more, I think. Maybe because it was just a more clear-cut story from beginning to end, even though it doesn't really have an end. Dune 2 has the big payoffs, the big denouements. Really happy to see it on the big screen with a nice sound system. Just enjoy Dune 1 more. Empire Strikes Back is amazing. Similarly, I still think my favorite Star Wars is 77, but it's a really close one. Like, watching Empire again, the Yoda scenes are so much fun, whether he's a mischievous little gremlin or a wizened, like, Buddhist Zen monk. He's the best. And for everything to culminate in that, and everything on Cloud City is gold. Lando, we haven't talked about Lando and Billy Dee Williams.
Yeah.
Like, the coolest dude in space with the coolest outfits in space.
Boba Fett. Best laugh.
How are you doing, Chewbacca?
Yeah.
Boba Fett, who's just... His outfit is so cool that they compose entire novels based on this one guy. Empire, the Cloud City stuff is just, it hits it out of the park, and you can see why it's been regarded as one of the finest films of all time. Good stuff.
Nice. Mm. Yeah, well, I'll start with Empire Strikes Back. Mm. I love this film. I agree with you, William. It's very hard. I'd be very hard-pressed to really choose a favourite, but I think I do prefer this one over the first one only because it has more amazing musical themes, because it has all of the great ones from the first one, plus the Leia Love theme and the flight through the asteroid. And then, of course, the Empire theme, which we've already discussed.
Can I add on to that a little bit with, I think watching again, it really struck me how much 3PO and R2 add to the movie. Because they react to things, right? R2 with his beeps and boops and 3PO in the asteroid scene with his, and it just adds to the excitement. It's the little spice on top.
Mm. I mean, famously, the first one is told from their perspective. Mm. Like, it's the Hidden Fortress narrative, the two peasants telling the story. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I love Empire Strikes Back. It's a joy every time. It's one of those movies I could watch it pretty much any time, any mood, with any group of people and be happy. Dune Part 2 for me is the best thing I've seen all year. I think I'm just going to be hard-pressed to replace it. We'll see at the end of the year when we do our wrap-up. I think these two films I haven't enjoyed a movie in the cinema like this since Mad Max Fury Road. So,
and it's long, right?
It's long. Isn't it like... It's 5 hours of content if you watch the two of them together. Mm.
And isn't it like 2 hours, 2.5 or 2 hours 45 or something? Yeah. So yeah, and it was wonderful.
Yeah. I absolutely loved it. And I'm really looking forward to seeing part three, especially because it sounds like Denis Villeneuve and his team are going to have to reshape, recraft, and find a new path with the source material. And I'm always up for that.
Mm. I really enjoyed Dune 2, as we said. And I'm pleased about that. And I'm really excited for part three. And Empire Strikes Back, look, it's tricky for me. I think it will always be an important film because, as I say, it was quite possibly the first film I ever saw. And I think the challenge for me is, 4.5 decades on, watching it and thinking, I'm not as engaged with everything that's going on because it's of its time or it's not as engaging or interesting to me. So it'll always have that, I'll always have that fondness for what it was. And I do think if I watch it again with my 7-year-old nephew, for example, I will enjoy his enjoyment of it being the right age to come in at that film, if you know what I mean, more than my watching it for my own sake.
Mm. Nice. Excellent. Well, thank you for listening to another episode of Cinema in Context. If you enjoy our podcast, then please share it with your film-loving friends. You can listen to Cinema in Context on SoundCloud, Spotify, Radio Public, Stitcher, Amazon Music, and Apple Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook, which are great places to let us know what you think of this episode, as well as give us suggestions for future films to discuss and compare. Look out for our next episode in a month's time, and until then,
no order mai.